I had the impression that Amsterdam had always been the city of bikes, let's say. So it really came as a shock to find out, to discover that, in fact, there was a period in Amsterdam's history when it was very much dominated by cars.
Amsterdam has been called the most bicycle-friendly city in the world. Approximately 40% of all the trips in the city are made by bicycle. For context, that number is around 2% in Toronto and London. So many cities around the world are striving to become more cycle-friendly, so we thought we'd find out more about the Amsterdam story. Thankfully, Jean Rowe, our podcast producer, has first-hand experience with the city.
I moved to Amsterdam in 2015, and today's guest is one of the first people I met when I moved there.
My name is Cornelia Dinka. I'm the founder of Sustainable Amsterdam. I organize study programs about sustainable urban development for international delegations. And the point of these programs is to share and transfer best practices from Amsterdam and Dutch examples internationally.
Within my first week in Amsterdam, I went on one of Cornelia's Sustainable Amsterdam bike study tours. And it was a perfect way to learn about the city from an urban planner's lens. On the tour, we biked through newer parts of the city, such as Amsterdam's first car-free neighborhood. And in the historic neighborhoods, Cornelia pointed out that these bicycle and pedestrian-filled streets were once dominated by cars. I loved how cycle-friendly the city was, and like Cornelia, I think I fell in love with Amsterdam immediately.
I ended up in Amsterdam. I came here for a date, actually, but sometimes I say that I actually fell in love with the city faster than the guy.
I could talk about why I love Amsterdam for a very long time, but we should probably get started on the interview. In this episode, John talks to Cornelia about how Amsterdam hasn't always been the biker's paradise that it is today. Let's get started. Here's John.
One of the things I wanted to chat with you about was your research during your master's studies and your photo series that compared historical photos with present-day photos of intersections in Amsterdam. Could you describe that research and what were some of the key findings?
When I first moved to Amsterdam, of course, I was kind of overwhelmed with how people and bike-friendly the city was. And this is something that really inspired my work later on and that motivated me to do my master's in urban planning, actually, and really make this massive shift from, more the environmental and resource kind of questions at a regional and even national and global level. I became really interested in the local solutions. I felt like that's really where all the solutions and all the enthusiasm and all the potential was at, and that's why I decided to do this master's eventually. But already at that point, I had come across, or I had done some research in how Amsterdam used to be in the 70s and in the 80s. So the thing that was even more surprising for me than how bike friendly it is today is actually the fact that it wasn't always this way. And especially because I think for a lot of foreigners, myself included, I had the impression that Amsterdam had always been the city of bikes, let's say. So it really came as a shock to find out, to discover that, in fact, there was a period in Amsterdam's history when it was very much dominated by cars. So that's something that I decided to explore further during my master's thesis. And I was really interested in the way, let's say, that the city transitioned from a city dominated by people in the 1800s and the early 1900s, and how this city then transitioned to a city dominated by cars starting in the 50s, so after the Second World War, and really aggravating the situation, getting much more car-centric by the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And then by the 1990s, we start to see a shift again, and then the emergence of a city dominated by people and bikes in the current day, let's say. And the reason I thought this was interesting or important is because I thought that if other cities could see that Amsterdam was not always bike friendly, then that could be really inspiring for them to realize that that meant they could also transform themselves. So that was, let's say, for me, the most interesting point. especially because I find that you could really do a similar photo series with the first two sets of pictures. So the pre-World War II and post-World War II, I think cities all over the world have transitioned from this city dominated by people to city dominated by cars. And what I think we have yet to see is this transition from the current state that's quite car-centric to a more people and bike-friendly situation for most cities around the world. And I think that's very, for me, that's very exciting because I think this is starting to happen in many cities around the world. I think there's very good examples of it. In Europe, in Paris, for example, but also in North America. And I think also starting in South America, starting in Asia as well. So I think this is I think it's maybe too slow, if you ask me. But I think it's one of these. I think we're waiting to see hopefully a tipping point when this is embraced, and then cities can really shift faster, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. And I think I've read in a few different places the term that Amsterdam wasn't always Amsterdam in terms of the what you see and think of right now, and the shift happening in the 90s is not that long ago. So how extensive that transformation and how relatively quickly that transformation can happen is super exciting. What were some of the key factors that led to that transformation? Was there a variety of folks? Were citizens advocating for it? Were politicians leading the way? Was it professionals and public servants that were doing it? What was that story like?
So it's really difficult to point to any single factor. And actually, it was really this convergence of different factors. One that I think is particularly interesting and inspiring is what's known in the Netherlands as the Stop the Kindermoord campaign. So that means Stop the Child Murder campaign. And this is actually a term that was coined by a journalist, not from Amsterdam, but from the south of the country, whose child had died in a car accident. As cities, Amsterdam included, as they embrace this, let's say, car-centric vision of modernity, and this was really popular at the time. In fact, you had experts from America, especially coming to Amsterdam and to other Dutch cities, and telling them about the kind of cities they should be building. And that really meant these modernist large buildings and these highways and overpasses. But to be against that, it meant to be against progress. So it's very difficult to be against it. So Amsterdam embraced this vision also. And it had started on retrofitting the city, let's say, for cars. So there was at least one large project that required the demolition of the old city to make room for some of these large roads and highways and large modernist buildings. But in this process, the number of traffic accidents started to skyrocket. So the peak in Amsterdam was more than 100 traffic fatalities in the early 70s per year, just in Amsterdam. And to compare that with the current day statistics, which is around 10 to 15 traffic fatalities and stable. So that includes fatalities, so people in cars, but also pedestrians and bikes and public transit and so on. So what that led to was this campaign, very much a bottom-up campaign, where people went out in the streets and demanded safer streets for children and by extension for everyone else. And the idea was that streets should be safe for children to walk and bike to school and to play in their neighborhoods. So this was, I think, very important because we see it actually also work today. If you talk about health and safety, that really captivates people much more than if you talk about the economic aspects, even, right? There's many different ways to approach this issue. But if you talk about kids, then that's something, and the health of kids and the safety of kids, then that was very, very impactful. You had at the same time smaller groups, for example, the people who were worried about preserving the old town. But they were seen as being maybe nostalgic. Yeah, they were seen as being against progress. Huh? So So you also had the people who were worried about the environment, actually. So you had a small environmental movement, people who were saying, okay, actually the car is having a negative impact on the environment, both from an air quality perspective, also from a broader perspective of, okay, there's no more place to walk in the city. The car is taking over all the public space. But these people were also, you know, seen as being quite fringy or being the hippies. So I think it's interesting how the child murder campaign ended up actually bringing a lot of people together. The other thing that you had was the oil embargo, actually. And that was the point when Amsterdam and other Dutch cities as well, in fact, started with car-free Sundays. And this is something that we see working quite well today. I think in Bogota, for example, they started with car-free Sundays. But this is something that happened in the 70s in Amsterdam. And it really, again, allowed people to experience the city in a different way, to see how else their streets could look and feel like. And that was incredibly inspiring, I think. So that was another very important factor. Something else that played a very big role in Amsterdam was actually, politically speaking, was an election. So in 1978, a new council was elected. And this new council took a very different approach to the way they wanted to develop the city. So whereas the councils previous to it were really embracing this vision of modernity that was around the car, the idea in the 60s and in the 70s, early 70s at least, was really that the old city had to be sacrificed. It's beautiful, but it's not economically dynamic or productive. And it's just a sacrifice we have to make, let's say. But this new council in 1978, they actually made a commitment to preserving the old structure and the old fabric of the city and to supporting public transport and cycling as opposed to car mobility.
So that council was that was an active part of their, you know, their campaign promise, if you will. So there was obviously some at the citizen level, this building interest or demand for this kind of shift. Hey,
exactly. So in that sense, the politicians were responding to what was happening in the streets or what the electorate was asking for. It was controversial in the sense that it wasn't, let's say, an overwhelming majority. It was a lot of people still were very excited about the promise of having their own car or having two cars per family and so on. And that continued even up until the 1990s. Finally, in 1992, there was actually a referendum in Amsterdam asking people if they were willing to reduce the amount of car parking space in the city and to put a price on car parking. So on the one hand, you know, in the 1978, you had a new government that was elected that already, let's say, started with a different vision. And yet throughout the 80s, there was this consensus that you should be able to drive your car and park your car everywhere. And only in the 90s was there a referendum on actually reducing the amount of car parking available and introducing paid parking. And even then, even when this referendum happened, the outcome of that referendum was to, yes, reduce the amount of car parking in the city, but it was very narrow margin. Actually, it was 51% of people who voted in favor of that. So it could have gone either way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That reminds me of this great quote that I refer to all the time from Donald Shoup, the professor at UCLA, that minimum parking requirements are like fertility drugs for cars.
Yeah. No, I mean, I'm a huge fan of his work. It's really inspiring. I mean, I think he invented the whole concept of parking management.
You're listening to 360 Degree City. Today, John is talking to Cornelia Dinka about how Amsterdam hasn't always been the biker's paradise that it is today.
There's a lot of converging circumstances and factors that you mentioned. When you talk to folks from other parts of the world, what are the things that you from the Amsterdam experience that you think are exportable to other contexts that may not have oil embargoes and maybe not even political shifts that are current. What are some of the things that you recommend that people take out of the Amsterdam experience to take back to their parts of the world?
That's a really good question. And actually, I see a lot of similarities in how these transitions are happening in other parts of the world. So one of the things that I hear about over and over again is the opposition of businesses to redesign streets. This is something that I hear from groups coming from Ireland and Canada and US and France and Spain and basically everywhere. Then people talk about, oh yes, but if we want to take any car parking away, then businesses will suffer and they will go out of business. And this is not true. I mean, it takes a while to test this and experiment with it. And actually, also it's useful when cities do a good job kind of creating some baseline and collect some data to really evaluate the impacts. I think Vancouver has started doing a good job with that, but I think maybe other cities as well. But that's just one example of how I think, because the same thing happened in Amsterdam, by the way. So the street that has been voted the most successful shopping street in Amsterdam and in the Netherlands, actually, when they started taking away car parking space and car movement space in the 80s, the businesses threatened to sue the government. And the government went through with the plans anyways. And since then, the amount of businesses on the street have more than doubled. So, but of course, it didn't happen overnight. There are these important lobbies. So that can be very difficult to overcome. And I mean, finally now, more than 30 years later, there are streets in Amsterdam where businesses are asking for less parking and for fewer cars, because now they've actually figured out this is good for business. But it's like 30 years later. So I don't know if that's encouraging for other cities. But I think certainly this idea of the car-free Sundays, I think that's something that other cities can really experiment with. And it helps that it's not just Amsterdam that provides a good example of that, but also maybe Bogota and Paris even, and many cities around the world, I think, who have embraced this. It's been very positive. The other thing that I think is very useful, again, is the idea of parking management, in the sense that you can actually raise funds and be able to invest those funds in more sustainable infrastructure. So in Amsterdam, car parking accounts for about 150 million euros that the city collects from parking management. And about 25% of that is actually reinvested in sustainable mobility projects. This is something that can be very difficult to do in other cities, mostly because regulations and bylaws prohibit the use of this money from parking on anything else other than parking, which is really unfortunate, because from a very basic, let's say, environmental economics perspective, what you want to do in cities, not just with mobility, but just in general, is you want to tax the things you don't want, the polluting things. You want to tax the negative externalities, and you want to use that funding and encourage the positive things that you do want. So in this case, you'd want to tax driving, and you'd want to use that funding to fund active mobility projects, for example. And I find it really fascinating and really depressing, maybe, actually, that doing this is illegal in most places around the world. So there's a lot of work to be done from, governance and institutional perspective to get our cities to even have the possibility to fund infrastructure in a sustainable way. So this is maybe the discouraging part.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the reality that persistence and patience is such a critical trait for folks that are trying to make these shifts, and to recognize that probably at this point in the history of those institutions that it's not intentional. It's now unintentional. There were reasons behind things, but the fact that they were really good, they became really good at building large roads or building certain kinds of developments. That means that they can, you know, it'll take time to shift, but the hope is that they can be good and really efficient at turning out these other kinds of forms of cities. So, that's one of the things that I think city builders all over the world need to, that's one of the critical traits, is to be patient, but still persistent at the same time.
Sure. Yeah. Lots of work to do for sure.
Yeah.
And optimism. I think it's a space where optimism is required for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things I just wanted to touch on was the idea of experiencing the change before maybe it's permanent. So the idea of car-free Sundays and things like that. And the work that you do with Sustainable Amsterdam, you give folks the experience of your city. Can you maybe talk about the importance that you've observed with folks from Ireland and Canada and Peru and all over the world, the impact that you've observed of actually experiencing these things that maybe you've seen on these folks have seen on a website or have heard about at a conference?
Yeah, and maybe I think it's also important to mention that when this transition started happening in the 70s, when people started asking for something different in Amsterdam, it was mostly people who remembered a different way that the city looked and functioned, let's say in the 40s or 50s or 60s even, before the car really became dominant. So in many cases, it was these adults who were thinking, okay, how come my children are no longer able to bike to school the way I was able to? So it was very important, actually, in Amsterdam and in other Dutch cities, that people had this awareness of an alternative reality. They knew there was something else that was possible. And I think the really unfortunate thing in places, in let's say North American cities in many cases, but many other cities around the world, is that people don't have the awareness of that reality anymore. So last time that Canadian cities or American cities were people friendly is so long ago that there's no one around talking about that potential reality anymore. Mm-hmm. On the upside, we do have this thing called the internet, and this is part of the way people are finding out about these alternative realities, and not accessible to everyone, but for the people who do have the possibility to get on a plane and go and experience these places somewhere else. I think that's also an important tool in creating that awareness or giving people the ability to experience another way of living, actually. Mm-hmm. I can think of some very special moments on some of my tours, actually. For example, when people just stop and they say, you know, why can't we have this in our cities, for example? Or I had somebody on one tour who said that for them the hardest part was knowing that his children will never be able to experience getting to school the way children do in the Netherlands. And that was just really difficult or heartbreaking, that to not be able to influence that or to change that.
Oh, wow.
So I think experiencing this other way of moving through the city and living your life, I think it can be very powerful. So this is also why in my work with these delegations, you know, sometimes the higher level that these delegations are, you know, if it's politicians, then I just really, my fantasy is always to hijack them and put them on bikes and take them around the city. But in many cases, if it is politicians, then somebody else decides that it's inappropriate to do that. And I think it's such a shame, because I think that's, you know, it's really the people who need it most, in a sense. I was actually in Seoul in South Korea just a week ago, and I had the pleasure of meeting the mayor, Mayor Park, who is a very progressive mayor. He's just finishing his second term and hoping for a third term. Elections are coming up. But he has taken, let's say, a much softer side, softer way to developing the city. So it's not, and over the last couple of terms, it hasn't been about highways and big projects. It's been really about rebuilding neighborhoods and helping people rebuild their homes, let's say, and actually trying to slowly transform what is actually a very car-centric city into a more human-centric city. And this is really not very easy at all. And he's somebody who actually said to me, you know, it's very difficult to change these things in Seoul, because over the last 30, 40 years, people have been told that the car is a status symbol, and it's really a symbol of progress. And you know, especially because politicians are usually the ones driving around, it means it's very difficult for them to make a decision about something that they don't know, don't understand, don't experience. So it is difficult, but there's some nice examples of politicians trying to make that happen.
Okay, so we close out with the same question for all our guests, and that is, can you tell us about a city you love and why? Now, I'll probably just say, except Amsterdam, because we've covered that a lot.
Oh yeah, okay. I have to say that actually, I'm not necessarily keeping track of it, but by now I've traveled to close to 50 countries, and it's usually very frustrating when you show up, you fly around, you know, halfway across the world, and you show up and every city feels like a traffic jam. This has become very difficult for me, incredibly frustrating. But I had the opportunity of going to Barcelona, actually, not too long ago. And I just found Barcelona to be an incredibly inspiring city. And there are parts outside the old city that are, unfortunately, still too car-centric. And for all the talk about super blocks, I was very disappointed to hear that it's much more talk than action, actually. But the old part of the city, and it's incredible actually how large that old part of the city is, the human fabric is just incredible. It's really a fantastic city. Not to mention, you know, the waterfront and the architecture and and the weather.
That helps.
Escaping the Amsterdam rain in December and January and being in 20 degrees on New Year's Eve was actually pretty incredible. But also, I mean, just really the atmosphere, the vibrancy. It really feels like a city where people go to pursue what they, you know, to pursue their dreams a little bit. It's maybe sounds a little bit phony, but I think actually that's the feeling that I had in Barcelona, that I think is very similar to Amsterdam, and maybe actually also very similar in Lisbon, I would say. And yeah, maybe one other thought on that. I think as a general statement, I would say, you know, that northern cities, so you know, Amsterdam and Copenhagen and Stockholm and Oslo, you know, these kinds of cities are very, let's say, functional. That's why we like them. And then southern cities are exciting, right? So when you think about cities in Spain and in France and in Italy and in Portugal, they're really very vibrant and very the energy of the people, right? That's what you go there for. And And I think the special cities are the ones that some, but by the way, the Mediterranean cities are not particularly functional. Huh? So the special cities are the ones that manage to really combine the functionality and the vibrancy. And that's what I think is special in Amsterdam, but also in a place like Barcelona is vibrant, but it's also incredibly functional.
Yeah, that's a really interesting frame on thinking about it, because the to recognize that those are both key ingredients and they relate to each other sometimes better than others. But yeah, I haven't really heard it described as that frame. And I know that there's a lot of technical folks that think if you've solved the functional part, then the rest will just come, which is not necessarily true. There's a diverse array of actors that help make that happen. But I like that. I really like that frame. And I was just in Barcelona in November. It has so much going on. It's just such a great place to be. You know, it's you don't have to necessarily do anything when you're there, although there's tons to do. It's just a great place to be, which is kind of a unique place for a city. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's actually the best cities are those places, like you said. You know, if you do nothing, but you just wander, if you just sit on a bench and you're just and you'd rather not be anywhere else, I think that's really I totally agree. That's what makes Barcelona special. And I think this kind of top-down, you know, kind of city as a computer or as a model, or kind of the engineering perspective of being able to control everything about the city, you know, it's really this functional approach. But there are examples of these kinds of functional cities that are incredibly sterile and uninspiring. And that's where I hope, you know, that's where I see that the role of urbanists is not gone, right? So it's, you know, I think don't put the computer engineers in charge of the city. I think keep the urbanists around, because I think creating places that people want to be is quite important.
While the context for Amsterdam's changes might be somewhat unique, what's exciting about the story is that the city provides the counter to the argument that there's no possibility for change because we've always done it this way. The change to a bicycle-friendly city didn't happen overnight, but it also didn't take a century. The Amsterdam story tells us all to be optimistic, patient, and persistent when creating change for our cities.
You can find out more about Cornelia and all the work that she does in the show notes of this episode. You can also check out sustainableamsterdam.com.
360 Degree City is created by our team at Intelligent Futures, a firm that works at the intersection of urbanism, sustainability, engagement, and design. We would love it if you subscribe, rate, and give us a review wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for stopping by.